Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there, I'm Stephen Colebrook, your host for today's episode of New Books in History. Today I'll be speaking with Nancy Toms about her important new book, Remaking the American Patient, How Madison Avenue and Modern Medicine Turned Patients into Consumers. It received numerous accolades, including a Bancroft Prize in 2017, one of the most prestigious awards in the field of American history. Toms charts how the rise of modern consumer capitalism shaped the culture of American medicine throughout the 20th century. Welcome to the program, Nancy.
Oh, delighted to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. We always begin our show by asking our guests what brought them to history. So how did you become an historian?
Well, when I went off to graduate school in the 1970s, I had never heard of the history of medicine. I wanted to do the history of women and the family. But I was fortunate that I ended up in a place, the University of Pennsylvania, that had the most amazing historian of medicine, really a giant in the field named Charles Rosenberg. And it was basically Charles who converted me to the history of medicine by getting me a job as a graduate student working in a historic hospital. So I got to handle all the old books in the medical library. I got to catalog the case records of the patients. And I'll tell you, I was hooked from that moment on, just that the humanness of what I found in those hospital archives. Now, one question people often have is, how can you do the history of medicine if you're not a physician? And I am not. I'm a PhD in American history. In fact, we have to spend a lot of time trying to master the science of medicine at the time. But in terms of my interests, I always gravitated more toward the patient side of the equation. So all of my work has kind of looked at that intersection of between doctor and patient. And that's been a theme across all the books that I've done, including Remaking the American Patient.
Excellent. So that nicely dovetails into my next question, which is that you've written several engaging works in the field of medical history, including The Gospel of Germs, which is an account of cultural attitudes towards disease in the early 20th century. And so I was wondering what brought you to the particular subject of healthcare consumerism.
In fact, it was when I was doing the work on The Gospel of Germs that the germ of the idea that later became Remaking the American Patient emerged. In the process, so what I was looking at is how ordinary people, not doctors or public health officials, came to believe in the existence of germs. Now we think bacteria, virus, but they thought of them just as germs. And I discovered this curious fact. If you look at the kind of the history of medical science, you find there was a lot of resistance among physicians initially to the idea of the germ theory, but entrepreneurs were really quick to jump in there and say, wow, this germ idea, I see some real potential to sell things. So I started looking at this whole world of commercial efforts to popularize the germ theory that start even in the 1880s. to sell things like antiseptics. Listerine, for example, starts in this time period. And it got me thinking about the role of advertising in shaping people's expectations of their doctors, but also their own health, how they interact with their own bodies. And it struck me of so forcibly how modern scientific medicine emerges in the United States at precisely the same time that modern marketing and advertising are emerging, and that the two are kind of growing up in the same field of influence, and they go back and forth with each other. So the idea was really, how does advertising influence the expectations we have of our health and our healthcare in this phase of thinking? I spent a lot of time looking at ads and getting interested in the history of advertisement. So that was kind of the jumping off point for the Remaking the American Patient.
Fantastic. So Remaking the American Patient begins with a description of 19th century models of medical consumerism. What was this tradition, and why was it replaced with more stringent forms of medical professionalism and drug regulation?
That's a great question, and one that I think about a lot, because some people argue that we may be going back to a 19th century model that basically in which anything went. In the United States, particularly, a lot of the more traditional regulations of medical practice and drug sales didn't make the leap, over the Atlantic. And it was, if you look at the, up until the 1890s, it was a snake oil paradise. If you had a product you said could cure cancer, you would put it in a bottle, slap a pretty label on it, and start selling it, sometimes off the back of a truck. There were very few legal or political ways to regulate that snake oil marketplace. This is the age of the patent medicine boom and the traveling medicine show. It's really quite fun to study these remarkable performers who were essentially taking traditions from American entertainment and other kinds of salesmanship and applying them to the sales of drugs. So it's a real Wild West show. It was one of the most interesting parts of my research for me, was to go back and to look at this this extravagant era of medical advertising.
So broader changes during the progressive era, such as democratization, professionalization, and the cult of the new, affect the rise of the patient consumer?
So one of the problems, of course, with this Wild West show is that a great deal of unsafe and inefficient remedies were being offered. For much of the 19th century, the medical profession, was saying, this stuff is garbage, come to us instead. And many people did. They both patronized regular doctors, but they also were going for a lot of the patent medicine remedies. There are also irregular doctors, as we call them, like homeopaths and botanical doctors. The mainstream medical profession, what become the ancestors of today's biomedicine, really were kind of hamstrung in their efforts to shut that down until the scientific revolutions in medicine at the turn of the last century. For example, the germ theory. Once regular doctors can start to say, look, we have a brand of medicine that's much better than what that snake oil guy has. You need to stick with us. You should only go to a doctor who's gone to the proper medical school and be licensed. In other words, in the late 19th, early 20th century, what we call the progressive era, there's a beginning to close down that Wild West show and to put more constraints on the who could advertise himself as a doctor, who could sell what at the pharmacy. So you see the beginnings of more regulation. This regulation is justified in that it's for the consumer's good. We need to make sure that you don't get access to dangerous stuff. One of the big issues at the turn of the century was the lack of information on the label. So somebody could be selling you a tonic that had morphine, heroin, God knows what in it, and you had no way of knowing because there was no legal treatment requirement that you put on the label what was in the product that you were selling. So a lot of the changes at the turn of the century are around this idea of consumer protection by improving labels on the one hand. So when you go in the drugstore and you see that bottle, you know, it has to say on the label if it has morphine in it. And in the doctor's office, you can be assured that if, Dr. Smith puts MD after his name, and it's mostly hims at this time period, he has been licensed by the state of New York or California as a doctor who's gone through the proper training. So it's a big turning point. Is it democratization? In a way, it's taking choices away from people. Bad choices. This is the theory. But the promise is this is safer, this is better.
Okay, great. So one of the sections of your book I found most interesting was where you sort of chart how in the interwar period, doctors used several methods to make their offices more enticing to middle-class patients because there was an increased demand for care. And so I was wondering if you could sort of chart the and describe some of the changes doctors made during that period in response to the increased demand for medical care.
This is one of, again, the most interesting parts of the book for me to go back because it really reminded me of my own evolution as a patient. When I would read descriptions of the new doctor's office of the 1920s and 30s, I would remember the doctor's office that I went to as a child growing up in Kentucky. My doctor must have read those articles because so much of what I encountered was, you know, straight out of the playbook of the time period he became a young doctor. So why was it important for doctors to become more welcoming to their patients and to redesign their offices? A big shift in this time period, and that I think happens in the UK as well, is that as medicine becomes more dependent on technology, there's a shift from home care to office care. So in the 19th century, physicians went to patients' houses, and the only people who came to the doctor's office were a tiny minority of his practice, usually single men who, frankly, were coming there for treatment, often for their venereal diseases. So office practice was just a tiny part of what doctors did in the 19th century. Fast forward, by the 1920s and 30s, the hospital is expanding as a site of care, and increasingly a doctor's office is sort of your portal. First you can come in there and you get new kinds of technology, like the doctor may have a microscope so he can, you know, look to see if there's something funky, you know, in your urine. Some doctors start investing in X-ray machines so they can give you an X-ray even in the office. They have all kinds of equipment that they're starting to use. So you really, the doctor is saying, look, I'm not going to make as many house calls. I need you to come to my office because I can give you a superior, examination. But a lot of folks were resistant to that. One of the big complaints, it starts in the 20s and it goes a long time, is my doctor won't make house calls. They did indeed still make house calls for very sick people or very young people. But if you were going to lure, adults just for kind of regular healthcare and, what is this bump on my arm, you needed to get them to come to your office. And that meant making your office more inviting. So instead of, some tiny nasty hole in the wall, doctors were encouraged to create a more comfortable office where you'd have a waiting room with comfortable chairs. They would say, you really need to make it inviting, have magazines on the table. One thing that just kind of horrified but also made me laugh is put boxes of cigarettes. That was considered a service to your patient. And the ads for doctors and cigarettes, there's like a whole chapter, right there. Anyway, so you would come into the waiting area and then you would go from the waiting area back into the doctor's office. And there was a whole kind of theatrical production of having your equipment laid out and having everything be very clean, having a nurse receptionist who would kind of ease your transition into the sacred space of the doctor. So just this fascinating, the doctor's office is the doctor's showroom. And to pick up on a piece of what you started the question, this whole theater was aimed at patients who could pay. It was aimed at middle and upper middle class Americans, most of whom at this time period are white and native born. Doctors wanted patients who could pay. There is no insurance of any sort in this time period. It is a strict economic transaction. Patient X comes in, gets a bill, the doctor sends the bill, the doctor wants the patient to pay the bill. So a lot of this window dressing is, also part of, hooked up with, and here's my bill, sir or ma'am, please pay it, in a timely fashion. Lots of stuff about bills, billing and bills.
Mm. So the second part of your book moves on to the post-war period, the 1940s through to the 1960s. And this is an era where there are lots of policy debates over whether the US should have a universal healthcare system, insurance, and eventually then, due to rising healthcare prices, Medicaid and Medicare are introduced. I was wondering both how healthcare consumerism interacts with these debates and how it interacts with the fact that the US does not, unlike a number of Western European countries, introduce a universal healthcare system at this point.
That there's a question that we've spent many an hour pondering. There's definitely, in my mind, a connection between this focus on attracting patients into the doctor's office and then the shape that the American healthcare system takes in the future. There's this kind of idea that in order to get the right kind of care, it is the patient's responsibility to choose very carefully what kind of doctor they go to check the doctor's credentials. And this is supposed to be your protection against getting bad health care. A lot of the resistance from patients as opposed to doctors to creating more state-centered forms of care centered around this desire to be able to walk with your feet. The way that you escaped medical care that you didn't like, that you didn't think was efficient, or you thought cost too much, is you would go to another doctor. So I think one of the underlying resistances to going to, say, a National Health Service kind of model was a fear that if your right to pick your own doctor was taken away, you could be victimized by physicians who weren't really giving you the care you wanted. I know this has been one of the hardest things when I talk to my British and I have a lot of Dutch friends that I talk medicine to about that idea that acting as a consumer was a form of protecting yourself is not an easy concept to get across. But in the United States, the idea of consumer power, is emerging very strongly. Even while you're talking the progressive era, the idea that in a market-based democracy, that consumers are kind of like market voters, and they need to have choice in order to reward good or bad care. That idea is really, I don't want to say hardwired, but it's like a very strong assumption in policy debates. And what it does is kind of mean it when eventually the United States realizes that it needs publicly supported insurance programs for the elderly, that's Medicare, people over the age of 65, and then Medicaid for low income people. The systems that are set up mirror the kind of private choice-based, allegedly consumer-friendly private sphere. So in many ways, Medicare and Medicaid, when they are set up, have extraordinary, this is more true of Medicare than Medicaid. They leave that concept of patients being able to choose their doctors is very important to the way those systems are set up. And because of the extraordinary influence until really the late 1960s of the American Medical Association, very conservative organization of physicians, in order to get doctors to participate in this system, they bargain and they win extraordinary freedom to set their own prices. And that is kind of as they did in the private sector. I mean, it was to go back to the economic transaction in the when you went to see the doctor determined the fee. You didn't go in and bargain, although some people would then try to talk it down or get the price down. In fee for service medicine, which is what we get in the United States, it's the doctor who sets the fee and tells you, this is what my service is worth. And that's a system that kind of has an inbuilt in, and what I'm giving you is really valuable. So I am, the phrase, what the market will bear, real upward trend in healthcare prices in the private sector that then is carried over into the public sector as well. Famous story about the passage of Medicare that when the then President Lyndon Baines Johnson was told, look, you are setting in motion what is going to become a medical inflationary machine by allowing physicians to determine the need for treatment and the cost of treatment. And he said, don't worry about it. Let's just get the system in place and we'll worry about that later. Well, we're worrying about that later. We've been worrying about that almost within a year of the passage of the Medicare, that inflationary spiral starts to kick in.
Excellent. So you also chart how a number of the social movements of the 1960s kind of appropriated the language and used the language of medical consumerism. So I was wondering if you could talk about how the idea of a patient consumer was used by movements like the Women's Health Rights movement and also other groups in the 1960s.
This was a fascinating part of the story for me because, again, I remember when a lot of these things happened, and yet as a someone living through the women's health movement, the bigger picture and also the relationship among the different movements was not so clear to me, and it was really interesting to go back and look at that time period from an older me to go back and look at that. One of the tensions that fascinated me was the growing disconnect in American political culture between the democratization and the idea that people should be given the opportunity to make the most of themselves and the deference to expertise. So you have both, you know, popular democracy, but you also have this idea that scientific experts have knowledge that you, a mere patient, can't possibly understand. So with this kind of as medicine becomes more biomedical after World War II, a growing distance between the doctor and the patient in terms of what the doctor knows and what the patient knows. And for, you know, not always the case, but for many physicians, a kind of arrogance that they didn't need to explain what they were doing, and that they, in the American pop culture, they call it the God complex. That, you know, you're a man in a white coat, and you should be able to do whatever you want on the body of your patient because doctor knows best. And that kind of medical entitlement really starts to come under criticism in the late 1950s, and then it just booms in the 1960s. That kind of asymmetrical relationship is dangerous. It's dangerous to the patient because the doctor is not listening to what the patient is saying. The doctor may be dismissing symptoms. The doctor may be ignoring the humanity of the sick person. And this kind of feeds into a sort of major shift in American culture and European as well, toward a reassertion of the right of the patient to be listened to. The concept of, or the sort of core principles of this 1960s version of consumer rights for patients becomes the right to be informed about what the doctor is going to do to you, what the side effects are, the right to refuse treatment if you don't want it. All of this emerges as a kind of democratic check on this more authoritarian medical tradition. In the women's health movement, this it's like a classic example of a particular group of patients who were treated as half-wits and very little consultation. The assumption, and again, most physicians in the 60s up until the 1970s were white men from relatively privileged backgrounds, that, you know, their assumption was the woman coming into their office was hysterical, irrational, and should be listened to as little as possible. So the women's health movement really blows up this, or really goes after this concept of authoritarianism in the doctor's office and tries to bring in the principles of a greater, a more feminist perspective, a more egalitarian perspective. And it's not just the women's health movement. You see in the civil rights movement, a growing awareness of how race figures into this kind of authoritarian style of medical practice. And when you bring this back to all the fussing about how the prices are going up, you're paying a lot to go see a doctor who may then not listen to you and do something to you that you don't want. Probably the best example of how these issues really start to come out into the general discussion are in treatments of breast cancer. It's a really terrific book, not by me, but by my friend Baron Werner, really looking at the style of medical practice where women would be taken into a surgical suite to have a biopsy done and wake up with a radical mastectomy. They were not allowed to be woken up and apprised of what the results of the biopsy were and to have any say over the surgical procedure. So a lot of the health consumerism gets focused on questions of informed consent to treatment, before treatment. And you know that it's really a game changer in terms of once organized groups of patient advocates start to say, no, I want you to wake me up and let me think about this before you do it. And this gets wrapped up with the radical mastectomy widely practiced in the United States at a time when surgeons in other countries are starting to do partial, you know, much less mutilating, and have equally good results. So it becomes a debate about the quality of the medical care itself. Is that the right procedure? And it kind of leads into this loop where increasingly you as a patient are told, you need to do your homework before you go to the doctor. And then if, you know, he suggests a radical mastectomy, you say, no, I'm really interested in this procedure I've heard about, where you don't have to do that. You know, it just feeds into this idea that you need to do your homework before you go to the doctor's office.
Fantastic. So the third section of your book charts changes in the final two decades of the 20th century during the Reagan era. And I was wondering how the commercialization of the health sector during this era, in particular through the growth of HMOs, for-profit medicine, affected the relationship between consumers and doctors.
Oh, boy. This is one of the saddest parts for me was, and I'll just back up and say, of all the parts of the book, this was the hardest for me to write, was everything after 1970, and especially the 1980s onward. And it's kind of reinforces the idea when the closer you get to the present, the murkier and the messier it is to try to figure out what's going on. But the 1980s are really a major turning point in American healthcare, because by 1980, when Reagan is elected, the results of Johnson's, you know, casual, oh, we'll deal with that later, the costs of healthcare have skyrocketed because now basically the federal government is paying for Medicare with no strings attached. And if you have one sector, Medicare, where the prices are going up, all the prices everywhere else tend to go up with them. So it's just, it's medical inflation had really reached, it had been bad before Medicare and Medicaid, but it was much worse. And there's a reckoning, and both Democrats and Republicans kind of realized that this can't go on. How do you fix that? How do you fix this system where doctors have so much control over both the decision of what care to offer and what to charge for it? Well, the answer comes out of alternative ways of financing healthcare, such as the HMO. In my work, I came to understand that there was a good HMO and there was a bad HMO. And what we ended up with was the bad HMO. The original concept of a health maintenance organization was a single place you would go. You would be have an initial gatekeeper, physician who would evaluate you and then send you to the specialist in that practice to have your appropriate treatment. So it was meant to be collaborative. It was meant to cut down on what was a huge problem in the United States, that you could go to a specialist without any kind of prior approval, and specialists always cost more than generalists. So it was meant to be cost saving. But to get people to buy in, the idea was you would join an HMO and then you would stay within that practice for your treatment. And there was kind of built-in cost controls there. The good HMOs said, well, we offer a higher quality of care. And they had some good evidence. They did, in fact, offer a high quality of care. But what's the sticking point? If you think back to my earlier point, does the patient get to choose the doctor? No. In an HMO, although actually you could, there was a lot more choice than critics said, but it became this kind of boogeyman. Oh, you go to an HMO, you don't get to choose your doctor anymore, and thus you lose control. You lose your ability to protect yourself. So HMOs are held up as an alternative to fee-for-service medicine. It's Republicans who really start offering these alternatives. It's Richard Nixon who says, hey, we got to look at this HMO idea. But it doesn't work the way its original enthusiasts hoped, because with this kind of suspicion I'm talking about HMOs, it's not so easy to get people to switch into that. But the other piece of it is the kind of idea of coordination of care and holding down of prices. That became an end in itself. When the kind of HMO idea does not take off, then you see the Reagan administration starting to look at other ways to get healthcare costs down by basically regulating prices. So you begin to get the diagnostic related groups. I mean, this is all too much in the weeds for your listeners, but that basically it's a system for deciding how much the federal government is going to give a hospital to care for Medicare patients. And that becomes the tool for controlling healthcare costs, puts a lot of stress on hospitals who are not used to this kind of oversight. And many of those hospitals had been using the overage and what they got from public money to take care of indigent patients. Unfortunately, the move toward more regulation of healthcare prices has, I don't know if it was an unintended effect or intended, but it starts to put pressure on the provision of care to people of limited means. And the train wreck just, it wrecks in so many dimensions once this spiral gets going. Managed care, managed competition. I mean, this all grows out of that same HMO concept that if you want to hold down prices, you really have to get doctors to compete with each other. And so the idea is if you make medical care, make doctors and hospitals compete over price, that that will help bring the prices down. Turns out it doesn't.
So how did the sort of interacting forces of managed care, increased HMOs and inflationary prices interact to mean that healthcare reform became difficult in the 1990s?
So there, I think by the time of the ill-fated Clinton plan, there was wide agreement on both sides of the aisle, in the Republicans and the Democrats, that these attempts to rein in medical costs were not succeeding, and that there was a real core problem here in terms of providing that choice of physician and treatment at the same time we were trying to regulate price. The kind of key shift that I saw in the 1990s is a lot of the healthcare reform in the 1980s was about bringing prices down, but it was less interested in the quality of care. What you get in the 1990s, especially when the Clinton plan goes down in flames, is a shift to, okay, let's try to improve the quality of care, and not focus just on the price. But the theory here was that if you could do a better job in getting people to the right treatment, that you could save costs, you could save waste. You know, the person going to the three different specialists before they find the right one. So there's a kind of shift to talking about quality. The problem again is that much of this talking goes on among policy planners and you know, think tanks. It doesn't translate well down to the level of patients making choices. They're being told that they have this responsibility to choose wisely, but the vast majority of them are by the 1990s in health insurance plans, some through their employer, some that they purchased on their own. They don't allow them this kind of freedom to move around and seek out quality care. And the kind of bitterness of managed care in the in this time period, or it's often around ways that insurance companies limit your choice by refusing to reimburse you for certain kinds of care that they deem unnecessary or inexpensive, and also the push to try to save money by having people spend fewer days in the hospital. You know, you've probably heard the expression drive-through mastectomy, and the women coming in to have babies to get you out of the hospital, you know, have the baby, leave. Mm-hmm. So this real pressure to kind of, it's an industrial attitude to get that patient in, get them out as fast as possible, that it generates a lot of hostility and distrust on the part of the patients.
So your book charts the complex interactions between this culture of consumerism and healthcare throughout the 20th century. How do you think it's interacting now during the current crisis that American healthcare is facing? Do you think it's having an overall positive or negative effect?
I'd say in terms of my historical interpretation, probably the biggest point I wanted to get across about the contemporary debates is to push back against the tendency to blame patients for making bad choices as the source of our healthcare problems. Patient blaming has, you know, become a big part of why does the American healthcare system work so badly? It's the patient's fault. And I just, I don't say there aren't some really dumb things that people do, but the system is set up in such a way that to explain all its faults through poorly informed choices, I think is just not only historically incorrect, but just politically unacceptable. So a lot of what I hoped by writing the book was to kind of dissect the way this whole patient as consumer, the patient who must shop, where that idea comes from, but to show how it hasn't worked, not because people don't try, but because shopping doesn't work well when it comes down to medical care, because so much of what's most expensive and most consequential, you don't choose. The doctor chooses it for you. And a lot of what consumerism came to mean, starting in the 1980s, was influence on patients to come in and ask for example, prescription drugs. We haven't talked about direct-to-consumer advertising, but that's very much a part of this market model that comes out in the 1980s, is you know, this tremendous effort to try to get patients to ask for specific drugs, specific treatments when they come to the doctor. And then when it turns out to be expensive or whatever, you blame them for asking for that treatment in the first place. So it's like a really, really perverse. There are all these perverse incentives that people are given to ask for expensive treatments that may or may not work. And then when they don't work and they cost too much, it's their fault. The other thing I really came to understand is how this whole model of the patient who shops is tilted toward white affluent patients. Nobody in this system wants the poor patient. They're a bad investment. So this concept of patient shopping is really so tilted toward people of means and away from people without means that is one of its fatal flaws. That said, when writing the book, I was critical of this kind of consumerism, and yet I didn't want to neglect the achievements that it did have. For example, the concept of informed consent, that you should not be treated like the women with the radical mastectomies. You should have some say over your treatment. Very hard balance, I'd say, to reach in terms of writing the book about how to point out the flaws, but also acknowledge the good that came out of it.
Well, I think we've taken enough of your time, Nancy. Thank you very much for speaking with us today. It's traditional for us to ask as a final question, what are you working on now?
Oh, what fun. I am following up on some of the insights I've gotten of why this idea of patient as consumer seems so strange in other parts of the world. So I'm part of research initiative to look at the history of how concepts like the patient who shops circulate in other parts of the world. That's really been fascinating. The other thing I'm working on is the impact of the internet on the concept of the informed patient. So medical Googlers and all that kind of interesting stuff. So what difference does it make to the concept of being a good patient when you can now go online and, you know, get access to the same medical journals that your physician is reading? So that has just been fascinating to me.
Well, I very much look forward to reading all of that research when it comes out.